Hi everyone. So first I'd like to thank BIPS for this invitation and the opportunity to share my current research. I'm really delighted to be here, and I'd like to acknowledge also the Leverhulme Trust, who've made this work possible through a major research fellowship. It goes without saying that this is a very difficult time to be talking about Iran, particularly Tehran, a city that's very close to my heart. Some of you may previously have heard me talk about the sounds of Tehran in 1908 when the then new parliament building was bombed by anti-constitutional forces supported by Britain and Russia. And I've also written about the sounds of Tehran during the Iran-Iraq War, and particularly the periods when Tehran was bombed. So there are clearly deep historical resonances with current events and what I like to think of as palimpsests of sonic memory. But for today, I'll be talking about my current project on the musical and cultural lives of Polish exile refugees in Tehran during World War II. So this work lies at the intersection of urban sound studies, music studies, and sensory studies. And as well as the focus on musical and cultural activities, I'm also interested in the wider sonics of displacement, the sounds of the refugees' journeys, their sonic experiences in their new temporary home, and the sounds that they brought to the already rich and complex soundscapes of Tehran. I explore the sonic entanglements between Tehran's various residents at this time, so war journalists, military personnel, and aid workers, as well as the refugees and local people, and the longer-term legacy of the Polish sonic presence in Tehran. So the aim is to better understand this little-known episode of Polish and Iranian history, one that has been largely forgotten, partly due to post-war politics and Soviet influence in Poland at that time. Centrally, I ask what a focus on auditory histories and sensory histories more generally might bring to our understanding of this period of Iranian history. So I'll introduce the project, and then I'll focus on the artist and singer, Irena Valdi Govebiowska, and I'll talk for about 45 minutes, and then I think we've got about 20 minutes or so for questions and discussion. So from at least the mid-19th century, Iran has been a place of refuge from those fleeing Tsarist Russia through to refugees from Afghanistan following the Soviet invasion of December 1979 and later from Taliban rule. One of the lesser known stories is of the Polish exile refugees I'll be talking about today. So first, some historical background. Following the German invasion of Poland on the 1st of September 1939, the Soviet Union annexed the eastern part of the country and deported an estimated 1 million Poles, as well as ethnic Ukrainians, Belarusians, and Lithuanians, including those regarded as socially dangerous or class enemies, such as landowners, intellectuals, teachers, and factory owners. Deportees were taken to labor camps in Siberia and other remote parts of the Soviet Union, where they lived in extremely harsh conditions. After the Soviets joined the Allies in June 1941, the camps were opened up, and many former prisoners traveled thousands of miles to. Could we have the next slide, Evalela? Thank you. I've got a map. So they traveled to Krasnovodsk, which is now Turkmenbashi in present-day Turkmenistan, and from there on crammed container ships across the Caspian Sea to the port of Bandar Anzali or Bandar Pahlavi in Iran, arriving in two main phases between March and August 1942. I've also got another map on the next slide, which is from the National Archives. If we could have the next slide, please. Which also shows some of the alternative migration routes. So the route I described wasn't the only route, but it was the main one. And the following slide is a photograph of Poles arriving in Anzali. Thousands died of starvation, cold, and disease along the way or on arrival in Anzali, where there is a large Polish cemetery. So, as many of you will know, Iran had been occupied by the Allies in August 1941, ostensibly because of Reza Shah's pro-German sympathies, but in reality to protect oil supplies and strategic routes between the Persian Gulf and the Soviet Union, as well as the borders of British India. So, when the Soviet camps were opened up, Iran was the closest territory under Allied control able to take in refugees. Many men and women joined the so-called Anders Army, a Polish unit operating under British command. Civilians were taken to Tehran, and from there, many of them, with the help of aid agencies, went on to other cities such as Esfahan and Ahvaz, and some onto camps in India and Africa. Numbers have been estimated at between 200,000 and 300,000, including around 13,000 children who were orphaned or separated from their families. Most were Catholic, with around 2,000 Jewish Poles in Tehran by the spring of 1943. And I probably ought to say at this point that the numbers are somewhat contested, but the ones I've given you are based on the work of historian Leo Sternfeld, to whom I'm much indebted for his research on this subject. And actually, the next slide is just an image of one of the camps outside of Tehran. The post-war settlement meant that few Poles returned home. Most ended up in countries such as New Zealand, Australia, the US, the UK, and Mexico, and many Jews went to British Mandate Palestine. A small number of Poles remained in Iran after the war. Some married locally and their descendants are still there. By 1979, there was still a small Polish community in Tehran. So the aim of this project is to better understand this history through a sonic perspective. What role did sound play in people's lives, both in the journey from the camps and in Iran itself? What were the entanglements between Polish and Iranian sonic worlds? The refugees would certainly have experienced new sounds in Iran, such as the call to prayer or the many street vendors described by older Iranians that I've talked to. And then there were the sounds that the Poles brought with them, both the ordinary sounds of everyday life, including language and musical and other cultural and religious activities. Studying history has sometimes been described as peering through the cracks, and this is certainly the case for the Poles in Iran, partly due to post-war politics, as well as barriers to accessing archives. My main sources to date have been archival documents, published memoirs, and some private collections that I've had access to. And I really hope to find more of the latter. I've mainly used the archives of the Sikorsky Institute, the Imperial War Museum. If we could have the next slide, there's a photograph from the IWM. And the National Archives at Kew, as well as online collections of the US Holocaust Memorial Museum in Washington, DC, that have good collections, and the Cressy Siberia Online Museum, including valuable oral history collections. There are still many sources to explore in both Polish and Persian, and I'd just like to acknowledge the wonderful work of my research assistants, Julia Pitko and Pantea Armanfar, who've been helping with this. In terms of extant writings, there are quite a number of published memoirs, I've already mentioned, in various languages, newspaper and magazine articles, and several documentary films. There is some academic research. If we could have the next slide, I've listed some of these, including books in Polish, a journal article and book chapter by Leo Sternfeld, concerned primarily with political matters, but with some references to cultural activities, and a brief section in Firuzeh Kashani-Zabet's book on US-Iran relations. There's little specifically on music, other than an article by Beth Holmgren on the musicians of the Anders Army, some online articles by Juliette Bretan, also mainly on the Anders Army band, and a recent article by Sara Yar Mahdavi and Habibullah Saidinia on the social and cultural activities of Polish women, including music. Memoirs and oral histories regularly refer to sound and music. So I'm just going to give a few examples. So if we could have the next slide. In an interview recorded in 2006 by the UK Association of Jewish Refugees, Ludwig Finkelstein, who was deported from Lvov, now in the Ukraine, with his mother, Amalia, recalls her singing to him in the camps, including patriotic anthems and cabaret songs. He also recounts how, arriving at Bandar Anzali in 1942, quote, "We waded through the water to the beach, dragging whatever possessions we had behind us. And as we arrived, we sang the hymn, Lord Who Saved Poland in Ages Past." Norman Davis's book on the Anders Army quotes from one Wiesław Stypuła about the competing sounds of Russian and British soldiers singing on the beach at Anzali. Sound here becomes a means of asserting power and symbolically claiming space. A testimony on the Cressy Siberia Online Museum, this is the next slide, is from Maria Kowodzinska, who recalls learning a song from a nurse whilst in hospital in Tehran. So she would have been very young at the time, and yet still remembers it many decades later, showing how deeply embedded such sounds can be in the memory. And I'd just like to play a short extract from this example, if we could have that over, Leila, thank you. Hopefully it'll work. It was working earlier. We seem to have lost the sound.
Zagoni pole, idzie sobie pachole, wielki wicher ulewa, ono idzie i śpiewa. Raz w nocy niedzielnej przy dzwonnicy kościelnej mróz wszelakie czucia ściął i Pan Jezus duszę wziął. Stary dziad mnie pochował, on mnie ubrał w sukienkę i znak zielonej dąbrowy. That's it. I still remember. I don't think I'll ever forget it.
Thank you. Despite the fragmented historical record, we know that a Polish cultural presence was established within a relatively short time, with schools, cultural associations, radio broadcasts, newspapers, and libraries. For those who remained in Tehran, many took on jobs within the emerging Polish community and beyond, as nurses, translators, teachers, secretaries, hairdressers, maids, waitresses, and tailors. Specifically in relation to music, contemporary writings offer tantalizing glimpses. So the next slide is a quotation from Sternfeld. Iranian newspapers reported on concerts and parties arranged by the Polish community and advertised invitations to the public. On April the 30th, 1942, the Iranian newspaper Etel Art announced the opening of a show with Polish artists in Tehran's theatre. A Polish jazz orchestra opened another night of entertainment in cafe-restaurant Shamshad. Quote, a dance party will follow the concert until 2 a.m., all for the price of 15 rials per ticket. Polish orchestras are also mentioned in a New York Times article by John Greeley. This is the next slide. Walking around the city, a visitor could easily find a hotel or garden offering traditional Iranian cuisine, excellent wine, and very high-priced European cocktails, all to the accompaniment of a Polish orchestra. The hotel at Darband and the Ferdowsi in Tehran proper are gathering places for the growing number of foreigners this war has brought: soldiers, aviators, refugees, newspaper men, diplomats, and others. Sternfeld also points to the wider impact on Iranian society, suggesting that even in such a short space of time, there was good integration into Iran's social fabric. So next slide, please. Polish exiles in Iran established newspapers, art galleries, cafes, orchestras, theatres and salons that catered first and foremost to the Polish community, but later became central to the myriad of allied army soldiers stationed in Iran, as well as to the emerging Iranian urban middle class. So one of the best known Polish venues was the Polonia Cafe and Restaurant, located in a basement on Lalezar Avenue in central Tehran. There were already a few European style cafes in Tehran by the 1930s, but the Polonia no doubt offered what felt like a more authentic European ambiance for the troops and refugees who shared the wartime city. There were also the sounds of religious spaces. Local Christians and Jews, including Iran's well-established Jewish community and Iraqi Jews who'd arrived shortly before the Poles, established relief communities to help their co-religionists. According to Sternfeld, Jewish refugees were given accommodations in synagogues and clubs or with Iranian Jewish families. Khosrow Sinai's beautiful documentary film from 1983, which is I've listed it on the next slide, A Lost Requiem. And I highly recommend this film if anyone's interested in this topic. Includes footage of a Polish church service in Tehran in the late 1970s. And just to say on an aside that it was actually through watching this film in 2015 that I first became aware of the story of the Poles in Iran and was struck by the fact that in the context of the so-called refugee crisis in the Mediterranean at that time, that here were Europeans given refuge in the Middle East, an inverse of the stories we tend to hear about and not so long ago in the span of history. So who were the Polish musicians in Tehran at this time? We have information, for instance, on a dance band called the Jolly Boys. Next slide, please. thanks to material held at the US Holocaust Memorial Museum that was donated by a nephew of one of the band members. So the Jolly Boys were invited to Iran in the summer of 1939 to play at the wedding of Mohammad Reza Pahlavi, and so were in Iran when Germany invaded Poland. They stayed in Tehran for the remainder of the war, becoming resident band at the Palace Hotel. We have very few recordings of Polish musicians in Iran at this time, but the Holocaust Memorial Museum holds two records made by the Jolly Boys in 1947. We could have the next slide. So these recordings were made shortly before leaving Palestine. Sorry, the next one, that's the hotel palace where they were resident. Yeah. So I thought it would be nice just to hear a short extract from the Jolly Boys band. This is a song called Kiedy, which means when, and just to give you an idea of the sound of this dance band at the time. Hopefully the sound will work. Thank you. Give you an idea of the sound. We also have some information on the Anders Army Band, next slide, that included leading musicians of the day, such as the composer Henryk Bartsch and the Associated Theatre Troupe, the Polish Parade. So the Sikorsky Institute in London holds some materials mainly on performances in Baghdad, Cairo, Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, but there are photographs and film footage of the band in Tehran, thanks to the Polish Army Film Unit. And if we could have the next slide, a recent project at the Documentation Center for Deportations, Expulsions and Resettlement in Krakow, led by Mario Solars. This project has recovered and arranged some of the songs from the Anders Army Songbook. Historian Beth Holmgren, who I mentioned earlier, has explored, among other things, the ethno-nationalist discourses promoted in the army, through which Jewish members were marginalized, and Jewish composers such as Warsch and Alfred Longin Schütz were criticized for composing music that was not, quote unquote, Polish enough. But my interest is more on civilian musical and cultural experiences. So one prominent figure, next slide, was the pianist Adam Kapuscinski, who remained in Iran after the war and became professor at the Tehran Conservatory, as well as piano teacher to the royal household. The next slide shows one of a series of papers relating to two concerts held in December 1942, at which Kapuscinski performed with two other pianists, Adam Rudolsky and Portnoy. Another musician is singer and actor Anna Borkowska, who features in Khosrow Sinai's film, where we see her and hear her playing piano and singing in her home. Anna describes taking part in theatre productions held both to entertain and to raise funds for the refugees during the war. She also talks about the painful experience of losing her brother Victor, aged 27, in the labour camps, not long before they were opened up. So Victor was a musician and had studied violin at the Warsaw Conservatory. So I'll move on now for the second half of my talk to focus on the case of one particular singer, semi-professional singer and artist, Irena Valdi Gołębiowska, who was in Iran between 1942 and 45. In October 2024, I was privileged to be introduced to Vaclav Hubert Sawadzki, Polish historian and grandnephew of Irena, who generously shared with me a photograph album cum scrapbook of photographs, postcards, newspaper cuttings, concert programs and reviews, and correspondence from Irena's time in Iran, as well as documents such as her passport and ID card. If we could have the next slide. And I'd ask you please not to take photos or screenshots of these images, as they're from Hubert's private collection and I'm showing them with special permission. And I just to express my gratitude to Hubert for sharing this material with me. When Hubert and I met and he showed me Irena's ID, I felt a strange thrill seeing her looking out from a distance of more than 80 years, a woman about whom I knew very little, other than that she had suffered a great deal in the early years of the war and later spent time in a city to which I feel strongly connected and where my parents were born and grew up. I imagined her waiting slightly anxiously in some government office in Tehran for her papers to be authorized. The handwritten words in French, Persian, and Polish were so visceral that I wanted to know more about the official who'd written them and who almost certainly had talked to Irena. I found it quite an emotional experience holding the card with its mix of languages bearing testimony to a historical moment when events had brought Irena to a country far from her home. I tried to imagine what life would have been like for a member of the Polish landed gentry turned semi-professional singer in Tehran. What were the circles in which Irena moved, and who were her audiences? Born in 1891 near Warsaw in what is now Belarus, at that time part of the Polish-Lithuanian Commonwealth, Irena was a talented painter and singer, but coming from a wealthy family, only sang occasionally in public, including once, I was told, according to the family, in a performance of Carmen at the Warsaw Opera. She studied at the Warsaw School of Fine Arts and often travelled to visit art galleries elsewhere in Europe. Irena was living in Lithuania when it was annexed by the Soviet Union in June 1940 and was subsequently arrested in August 1941 and sentenced to 15 years in a labour camp in the Urals for refusing to accept Soviet citizenship or to work as an artist for the regime. Together with her sister Maria, she spent about 6 months in the camp where living conditions were harsh and the main job was cutting down trees. When the camps were opened up, Irena and Maria travelled with the Andes Army to Iran, where they stayed for the rest of the war. In Tehran, Irena was able to draw on her talents as a singer and gradually established a reputation, working under the stage name of Valdi. This enabled her to make a small living, supplementing her army stipend as her husband was an officer. Irena and Maria were well educated and spoke French, German, and Russian, as well as Polish. Maria, who was also musical, took a job as secretary at the Polonia Club, which I've already mentioned, and also occasionally played piano, including accompanying Irena in some of her recitals. And the next slide is a picture of Irena and Maria in Tehran. After her recent experiences, Irena found some peace in Tehran. Hubert reports that her memoir, if we could have the next slide, quote, records her feelings of happiness at having found peace and rest in the beautiful Iranian capital after the horrors of earlier experiences, and how she could never have imagined that she would find herself in Persia with its sunny and blue sky, and how she was enjoying beautiful Persian roses known to her only from fairy tales. Tehran in the 1940s was becoming increasingly cosmopolitan with a more open cultural sphere following the departure of Reza Shah and the arrival of allied troops, journalists, aid workers, and so on. And this impacted particularly on the entertainment district around Lalezar Avenue with its cinemas, theatres, and international hotels and cafes. As such, Irena arrived in a city that was experiencing a relatively new and vibrant nightlife. Her collection of newspaper cuttings suggests that she mainly performed in somewhat exclusive settings rather than solely within the Polish community. Newspaper announcements and reviews include print media in English, French, for instance, Le Journal de Tehran, and Polish. There's an invitation and programme, this is the next slide, for a concert held on the 6th of March 1945 at the Syro-Lebanese Club, in which she was accompanied by Maria, who also played some solo pieces. A review published in the Gazeta Polska of Jerusalem on the 28th of March reports that the concert was well attended by, quote, an excellent high-quality audience. Other performers were Zorik Esdilanian on violin, likely an Iranian Armenian, judging by the name. I've not been able to find any information on him. And a pianist, J.S. Summers Cox, who, according to the review, was a secretary at the British Embassy. And I've also seen documents that show that he was involved in the Anglo-Iranian Dramatic Society in Tehran at the time. As you can see, the repertoire was all classical music and included Polish composers Chopin, Wieniawski, and Moniuszko, as well as Bizet, Tosti, Mozart, Mendelssohn, Sarasate, and Prokofiev. Another concert was held at the Anglo-Persian Institute, this is the next slide, on Ferdowsi Avenue on Wednesday, the 13th of June, 1945. A newspaper notice offers insights into other activities at the Institute. So there's a talk on Milton's England and a film on England Shakespeare. We also learn that the Imperial Bank of Iran, which was controlled by Britain at this time, was to be closed on the birthday of King George. As well as the programme, Irena's papers include a letter, next slide, in French, dated the 29th of June from one David Hicks at the Anglo-Persian Institute, thanking her for the recital and expressing hope that they might hear her perform again soon. It's not clear how often Irena sang in these relatively privileged settings. An undated newspaper clipping in French, so this is the next slide, announces that, quote, "For the first time in Tehran, the famous Polish singer Irene Waldie would perform every evening in the gardens of the cafe restaurant Shemiran between the hours of 9 and 10 p.m. Whilst this venue was less exclusive than the aforementioned clubs, the audience would still have primarily been from the international community in Tehran, as well as more affluent and well-connected Iranians, and less likely to have included many Poles. We don't know how long Irena performed at the cafe restaurant Shemiran. It was probably for the summer months only. Irena also sang in spaces where the audience would likely have been primarily Polish. So one newspaper clipping is an invitation from the Committee of Ladies attached to the Society of Polonia for an artistic evening with the participation of Mrs. Waldie Gobojowska and Mr. Adam Kapuczynski at the Polonia Club on Friday the 7th, we don't have the month or year, at 1800 hours to raise funds for the society. Entry for members is listed as 2 rials and 4 rials for guests. Tea was also to be served. According to another undated clipping in French, this is on the next slide, Irena sang for Radio Tehran, which would have given her a much wider audience, including amongst local Iranians. According to her family, Irena even claimed to have sung for the Shah, which is possible given her connection with Adam Kapuczynski, who had a presence at court. Irena's photograph collection includes a picture of the Shah's palace at Saadat Abad in North Tehran. What emerges strongly from these scattered fragments is that Irena was a colourful character who was able to take advantage of arriving in Tehran as an unknown entity and with a slightly exotic Polish cachet and in a possibly more cosmopolitan environment than back home to reinvent herself as a minor celebrity within international Tehran circles. And it seems she had many admirers. In her work on musicians and social liminality, sorry, next slide, please. Catherine Schofield argues that, quote, "Musicians in many societies seem to possess social liminality, unusual cultural sanction to cross ordinarily strict boundaries that are of significance to a particular society." Schofield's work focuses on professional musicians of lower status, which was not the case here, in that Irena's marginality was due to being an exile refugee rather than because of her class. Still, through her music, Irena was arguably able to transcend this liminal status and to enter certain elite spaces that would otherwise likely have been closed to her. It's probable that had her life in Poland continued uninterrupted by the war, she wouldn't have pursued a singing career. But having experienced the trauma of imprisonment and loss, including of family status, music became a means by which to regain some of her former social standing and even to create a new persona, allowing her also to act in some ways as a cultural ambassador in her temporary home. As well as music, Irena continued with her art. So next slide. Her memoirs record that she painted during her time in Iran, as well as acquainting herself with the work of Iranian artists. She also learned how to make dolls in national Polish costume. A Polish doll factory had opened in Tehran, and she may well have taken lessons there. Irena left Iran for Lebanon in 1945. She stayed in Beirut for 3 years before coming to the UK, where she lived in various Polish resettlement camps, eventually moving to Leeds. Judging by her collection of newspaper cuttings, Irena maintained an interest in Iran, so there's even one reporting on the 1953 coup. Irena never returned to Poland, even to visit. In the UK, Irena continued with her art and held exhibitions at which she also sold work. For instance, at the Leeds Polish Club, the Manchester Polish Ex-Servicemen's Club, and in Huddersfield. Irena also performed occasionally. For instance, one newspaper cutting reports on a concert held at Cannon Hall near Barnsley in Yorkshire in 1949. Every summer, Irena travelled to North Wales to Penrhos, a village where mo many Polish people lived and where others would go for their summer holidays, and where there's still a Polish nursing home. According to Hubert, Irena loved Penrhos, where she would sing, play bridge, and paint. And it was there, at Penrhos, that Irena died of a heart attack in 1979. Maria stayed on in Tehran after Irena left and later returned to Poland. Hubert relates that, based on Maria's letters to his mother, for many years she regretted leaving Iran, where she had been happy, loved the climate and people, and had a good job. She was deeply nostalgic for the lost world she knew before 1979, but eventually found an administrative post at the Warsaw Conservatoire, which she enjoyed. Maria died in Warsaw a few months after Irena. So I've shared with you some of what the existing documents tell us about Irena and Maria's lives in Tehran, but there's much that we don't know, including, for instance, where they lived. So Irena used the Polish Red Cross in Tehran for her correspondence, the extent to which they interacted with other Poles, including musicians, and how they managed to build local networks within a relatively short time and gain access to elite spaces, as I've discussed. Unfortunately, I've been unable to find any recordings of Irena, and I'm trying to find out whether the Radio Tehran broadcasts still exist, although that's quite doubtful. So, what do these fragments and the many I haven't had time to talk about tell us about the sounds of Polish Tehran? Notwithstanding the gaps, the items in Irena's scrapbook album place her physically within the various spaces of Tehran that she spent time in. The photographs, program notes, invitations, and thank you letters allow us to understand something of the geography of Irena's presence in her adopted city and to some extent her relationship with it. So, using these documents, I've been trying to map this presence as well as that of other Polish musicians in order to get a sense of the sound spaces of Polish sociality in Tehran at this time, with a focus on the area around Lalezhar Avenue. So if we could have the next slide, please. So Lalezhar, which since the 1920s, as I've mentioned, has de had developed as Tehran's main entertainment district, and by the 1940s was the hub of its nightlife. So there's a map showing the location of Lalezhar Avenue. And the photo in the slide is actually from Irena's collection, and you can see the mountains in the distance, you could see in those days, no longer. So, in terms of mapping, if we could have the next slide, here's what I've got so far with the help of my PhD student, Pantea Armanfar. And really, it's just a start. It's hard to read the street names, but Lalezhar is the one with the Polonia Cafe on. And there's a link on the slide to the interactive version of the map online. Most of the documents place Irena in two main parts of Tehran. If we could have the next slide. First, Darband in the far north of the city, so number 11, close to the start of the mountain trails and the location of the Darband Hotel and cafe restaurant Shemiran. And second, the area around Lalezhar Avenue in central Tehran. And just to say that whilst Lalezhar lost much of its splendor after the 1979 revolution, when many of the venues were closed down, memories of its former glory are still strong in the national imaginary and often invoked nostalgically in many ways. But for instance, in historical TV drama series such as Shahrazad from 2015, and another series, Khatun, from 2021, so Khatun is actually set during World War II, the series includes a reconstruction of Polonia and includes a storyline related to the Poles in Tehran. So we know that, if we could have the next slide, we'll go back to Lalezhar. We know that Irena and Maria spent time in this area. Maria worked at the Polonia and Irena performed there at least once, maybe more. On nearby Ferdowsi Avenue is the Anglo-Persian Institute, where Irena sang in June 1945 and possibly on other occasions. Other popular spaces of sociality nearby include the legendary Café Nodary and the Grand Hotel. We can't be sure, but it's not unlikely that the sisters would have visited or been taken as guests to Café Nodary, or perhaps went dancing at the Grand Hotel. The newspaper sources quoted earlier mentioned Polish orchestras in venues such as the Café Restaurant Szemszard and the Ferdowsi Hotel, both also on the map. Although working in rather different musical worlds, I like to imagine, inspired by Sadia Hartman's idea of critical fabulation, that the paths of musicians such as Irena, Maria, and the Jolly Boys might have crossed in these streets. The Polonia was, after all, just a short walk from the Palace Hotels where the Jolly Boys were resident. Hosro Sinai's documentary film, A Lost Requiem, which I mentioned earlier, if we could have the next slide, please, includes footage purportedly from the Polonia during World War II. Whilst making the film in the 1970s, Sinai visited the basement space where Polonia had been, and the space by then was a chocolate factory, and it actually later became a print shop. And I'm just going to play a 1 minute extract from the film just to give you an idea. There's a very interesting history of the film, which I don't have time to go into, the sound quality is quite poor, I'm afraid, but it will give you an idea. Yes, if we could have that, thank you.
Here on La Lazare Street, I found a small chocolate factory which was once the Polonia bar and restaurant.
Tam chyba czujesz, jak śmiesznie to brzmi. Pewnie już o tem wysłałeś mój złoty, że są pewne rzeczy, o których nie
Polonia means Poland, and many Polish women had no choice but to come to places like this to keep the company of the soldiers of the Allied forces who came to Iran during the war.
Zatem tęskny dziś, o ten marzy dziś, może spać, gdy ty tak to myślisz. Musisz kurczem zrozumieć dziś treść moich snów. Jeśli mnie trochę miłujesz, bo jak nie kochasz mnie, to choć powiem ci, to i tak nie
zrozumieć. Actually, just go to the next slide. If you just go to the next slide, then that's great, thank you. At the southern end of the map is Darul Funun, a college of advanced education founded in 1851 and where the December 1942 concerts with Adam Kapuscinski and other pianists that I mentioned earlier took place. These concerts were intended for students at the Hon Aristan, the high school conservatory, as well as Iranian musicians and music lovers in general. The concerts were free and by invitation via specially printed cards. It seems that the repertoire was mainly by Chopin, about whom one of the musicians also gave a pre-concert talk. So to conclude briefly, this project is very much in process. We're currently working through oral history recordings and memoirs, as well as documents in the Sikorsky archive on the Polish schools in Iran, and a magazine produced by the pupils called M, which means us. And this includes information on musical activities. The next slide is a photo from one of the Polish schools in Esfahan, which was kindly shared with me. Thank you. Another interesting publication we're looking at is Polak v Irani, which means Poles in Iran, almost 100 issues of which were published in Tehran between 1942 and 44. And the next slide is an example of the kind of thing we're coming across. And I'll just pause so you can read the translation. So when I read this, I just became really intrigued by these listening groups. Unfortunately, we haven't yet found more information on these groups, but I'm hoping that we might do so. In terms of the anticipated project outcomes, as well as a book and some articles, the plan is for public-facing activities and to make this story better known, including an exhibition, a radio program and a concert featuring a specially commissioned piece by Yulia and Pantea, who, as well as being research assistants on the project, are both sound artists in their own right. So the piece will be created by two young composers, one Iranian and one Polish, reflecting on this shared history. I'm hoping that the archives and personal collections will yield further information that will allow us to build a richer picture of the sounds of Polish Tehran and the sonic and wider sensory lives of the exile refugees, their entanglement with others in the wartime city, and the long-term impact on Iranian music and culture. And if we could have the final slide, that's just a thank you. Thank you for listening.